Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Council Allocates Coronavirus Relief Funds by Michael Merlot. The Odessa City Council allocated Community Development Block Grant Coronavirus Funds, CDBG-CV, and Coronavirus Relief Funds to multiple local nonprofits in Odessa during its Tuesday work session. During the last council meeting, withdrawn applications changed the amount requested to a sum of $771,500, but the council still fell short with CDBG-CV funds totaling $514,533. The council had consensus for the allocation, except for $204,961 to Meals on Wheels for food assistance, and $134,500 to Family Promise for a new trailer as a day center and transitional home for struggling families. The allocation was tabled because the council wanted to see if they could get both of those projects funded. Members voted to approve the allocations in a unanimous vote. Also during the work session, council allocated $108,000 of Family Promise's request for the trailer. They also voted to allocate $101,963 of CDBG-CV funds to Meals on Wheels, along with $103,000 from CRF money. For the rent and mortgage allocations, the Salvation Army received $85,000. Sharing Hands, a Respite Experience, SHARE, received $50,000, and Odessa Links received $28,100. For homeless assistance, Family Promise received the $108,000 for the trailer and $35,000 in food and homeless assistance. Odessa Links also received $26,490 for homeless assistance, and the Centers for Children and Families received $50,000, which will go toward mental health counseling. District 5 Council Member Mary Willis said she wanted to keep those accountable for the money. I just want to make sure that the auditing process is in place and we make sure the money is spent and that nothing is left undone and it's spent for which we are assigning it to, she said. At-large Council Member Peggy Dean said they need to be sure that the $103,000 of CRF funds are spent by December and that CDBG-CV funds were used for how they were allocated. City Manager Michael Marrero added that it is a very rigorous qualification process for the CDBG-CV funds. There are requirements. It's not anything that they simply get the dollars. This is a reimbursement program, so all of the costs will have to be justified, he said. Coffee and Community. Odessa College has scheduled Coffee and Community Conversation, The Pandemic, the Economy, and the West Texas Spirit from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Thursday at www.facebook.com/Odessa College. Responsive Education to Open High School in Odessa. Responsive Education Solutions plans to open a premier high school this fall in Odessa. The location will be 1801 North Lee. Regional Director of the Odessa Campus, Tanya Bell, said they will follow the Ector County ISD calendar, so when ECISD schools open, Premier will open. The first parent meeting is scheduled for 6:30 p.m. this Thursday at the MCM Grande Fun Dome, 6201 Business I-20. It will be a campus for students in grades 9 through 12, but their charter with the Texas Education Agency allows them to serve students up through age 26. It is not uncommon for us to graduate students who are 23, 24, 25 years old, who for whatever reason or the other had to interrupt their learning and they did not finish their high school, Bell said in a phone interview. She said those students want a diploma so they come back and complete with responsive ed. They learn in a separate classroom and not with younger high school students. The building Premier is going into is being renovated. It's coming along well. It's on schedule. We're on schedule to get it finished on time, barring anything unforeseen, Bell said. Responsive Education likes their schools to be small by design. The typical number of students ranges from 120 to 200 students, Bell said. She added that the goal is to have 90 students for the first year in Odessa and expand as they grow into next year. Responsive Ed has 74 campuses in its family of schools across Texas and into Arkansas. It is a family of schools. It's not just Premier High School. There are five different school brands, and Premier High School is just one of those brands, Bell said. In our Responsive Ed schools last year, we served over 20,000 kids in our family of schools. And we are an open enrollment, free public education school. We are accredited with TEA. Our kids do take the STAR test. We have accountability with the state. We do have to meet all of that, she added. Under the last STAR results and state accountability ratings, Premier High Schools overall were rated a B. Bell said the schools serve students for whom the traditional school is not working. We like to serve at-risk students. That's just who we target, the kids who are falling through the cracks for whatever reason, Bell said. They also serve students who want to graduate early, get on with employment, a trade school, or college. The school also offers credit recovery. Things happen to kids, and our oil field children move a lot. We have kids who come from California. We get kids who come from Wyoming. We have kids that come from Louisiana and Mississippi and New Mexico. Their parents work in the oil field, and these kids move a lot. And so sometimes as a result of that, they have lost credits, and they need to make up those credits. So we are also a credit recovery that allows them to make up those credits and graduate on time, Bell said. She added that Responsive Education is expanding all the time. They have a premier high school in Midland and campuses in Lubbock, San Angelo, which opened 2 years ago, and Amarillo. Bell said a campus director and office staff are in place for the Odessa High School, and they have hired some teachers. More will be hired as they grow. This is a student-directed, mastery-based program, so the students direct their learning, and the teachers facilitate that learning. They facilitate that learning in small groups and one-on-one instruction. Classes have 25 to 30 students, but some students are working on their own while teachers are working with small groups. And it really works well, Bell said. She noted that the curriculum translates well to online and in-person instruction. Our curriculum is available to students right now. Let's say pre-COVID times, our students had an option to do paper pencil curriculum, or they could do an online curriculum even while they're at school. Our curriculum is available both ways, Bell said. There will be face-to-face and online options for students, but it's all the same program. And it's all still mastery-based with the teacher help to make sure the kids are making progress and no one is falling through the cracks, Bell said. She added that Responsive Ed had a leg up when it came to contacting students and families because of its small size. We know all our kids' names. We know how to get hold of them, Bell said. Obituaries for Wednesday, July 22nd. Clarence C.A. Anthony Smith. C.A. Smith was born August 24th, 1930, in Healton, Oklahoma, to Verda Matthews Smith and Tom E. Smith. He is preceded in death by Tom and Verda and a sister, Olive Bell Smith Teal. He married Betty Iva Jo Bird in 1953, and they were married 59 years before her death. C.A. is also preceded in death by a grandson, a granddaughter, and a son-in-law. He is survived by his daughter, Connie, and husband, Dyke Culp, Dale, and Randall, and wife, Tammy McMillan, as well as 8 grandchildren. He is also survived by 11 great-grandchildren. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, July 24th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home Chapel with Don Pruitt of the Rogers, Arkansas Church of Christ officiating. Interment will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. To send family condolences, please sign CA's guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Donations can be given to the American Heart Association. Jose Rude Joe Chavez. Midland. Joe Chavez passed away at the age of 69 at Midland Memorial Hospital. He was born March 10, 1951, in Pecos to the late Antonio R. and Maria Rude Chavez. He was preceded in death by a brother, Ernesto Nito Chavez of Pecos, sisters Beda Machuca, Josefina, Josie Antillon, and Susanna Perkins of Odessa. He married Isabel Rodriguez in 1972. He is survived by his children, Kennedy Chavez, Stanley Chavez, Desiree Nieto, and Jacob Chavez, all of Midland, 11 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren, his brother Benito Chavez, and 3 sisters, Maria Louise Saiz of Andrews, Teresa Chavez, and Isabel Chavez of Odessa. Viewing was held Tuesday, July 21st, and from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Wednesday, July 22nd, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. A funeral service will be held at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel in Midland, Thursday, July 23rd at 2 p.m., with interment to follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Christina Padilla Gabaldon. Christina Padilla Gabaldon, 58, of Carrollton, passed away July 18th in Plano. She was born in Chihuahua, Chihuahua, Mexico, to the late Jose Padilla and Hortensia Lores Padilla on March 18th, 1962. She married Eliseo Gabaldon in 1989 in Chihuahua. Christina is preceded in death by her father, Jose Padilla, maternal grandparents Candelario and Pilar Larez, and paternal grandmother Josefina Jimenez. She is survived by her husband, Eliseo Gabaldon of Carrollton, her children, Eric Gabaldon and wife Jennifer Silva, Eli Gabaldon, Alexis Ventura and husband Sergio, all of Carrollton, her siblings, Jaime Padilla and wife Norma, and Jose Junie Padilla of Odessa and Sylvia Padilla of Carrollton, her mother Hortensia Padilla and stepfather Samuel Payen of Odessa, as well as several nieces. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, a memorial service will be held at a later date to honor her. Leandra Isabel Rios Olivares. Leandra Isabel Olivares, 73, of Odessa, passed away at home Saturday, July 18th. She was born Tuesday, November 5th, 1946, in Alpine to the late Albert Rios and Ilaria Inoos, the oldest of seven children. Surviving her are her husband of 54 years, Jose Alonso Olivares Jr., sons Jose A. Joey Olivares III, Albert L. Olivares and wife, and George A. Olivares and wife, all of Odessa. 12 grandchildren, 9 great-grandchildren, as well as her siblings. She was preceded in death by her parents, a brother, Daniel Danny Rios Sr., and a sister, Elizabeth R. Cortez. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. Wednesday, July 22nd, and from 9 a.m. to noon Thursday, July 23rd, at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, July 23rd, at Hope Alive Church, officiated by Cliff DeArmond. Condolences to the family may be sent online at acreswestfuneral.com. Death notices. Alvin R. Alford. Alvin R. Alford, 74, died Saturday, July 18th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Eugenio Jean Castillo Jr. Eugenio Jean Castillo Jr., 54, died Monday, July 20th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Nicholas Nick Flores Sr. Nicholas Nick Flores Sr., 67, died Monday, July 20th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Renee H. Martinez. Renee H. Martinez, 82, of Odessa, died Friday, July 17th. A chapel service was held Wednesday, July 22nd at Martinez Funeral Home Chapel. Ernest Trevino. Ernest Trevino, 42, of Odessa, died Saturday, July 18th. A celebration of life was held Tuesday, July 21st at Acres West Funeral Chapel.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, July 20th, 2020. This is the local and state page. Earl Campbell helped change the name of Lee High School in Tyler, by Kevin Sherrington, Dallas Morning News. Trude Lamb's letter to the Tyler School Board last month was evocative and polite and blunt. No longer would she run cross-country in a jersey bearing the name of a Confederate general, and furthermore, the board should change the name of 62-year-old Robert E. Lee High School to something, quote, we can all be proud of, unquote. Next thing you knew, the letter went viral. Trude, a native of Ghana, became a national celebrity and local pariah, a symbol to some Tylerites of the outsiders who would wipe out their heritage in the furtherance of Marxism even anarchy. And so it went at a special meeting Thursday, live streamed on YouTube, at which 40 residents made pitches for and against before the 7-member board voted to change not only the name of Lee, but the district's other high school, John Tyler, on grounds that both were named after Confederates. Of course, it wasn't only Trude and her letter that made history, as a supporter put it, and it wasn't outsiders either. Unlike predecessors who kicked the can down the road for 50 years, the current board, including a former SMU football player, performed its duty. A former state senator and mayor, now chairman of Texas's Board of Regents, had a hand in influencing the board. Earl Campbell, too. "You get the Tyler Rose," said Marty Crawford, Tyler's superintendent of schools. "How can you argue with that?" Powerful voice. History. According to figures compiled by the Southern Poverty Law Center, Texas leads the nation in the number of schools named after Confederate figures at 34. Nearly three times as many as runner-up Virginia, and more than a third of the total nationwide. Since the summer of 2015, when 9 blacks at a Bible study in Charleston, South Carolina, were killed by a white supremacist who posted racist emblems and a Confederate battle flag on his website, a national recall has been in order. Texas alone has removed 33 Confederate symbols. Not that the wave of change didn't meet occasional bulwarks. At a Tyler school board meeting in the fall of 2017, Andy Bergfeld, a wide receiver at SMU in the late 80s and a member of one of Tyler's most prominent families, posed a question. Is it right to force African-American students to attend a school named after the most famous and honored Confederate figure from a war whose underlying purpose was directly or indirectly to protect the institution of slavery? Bergfeld didn't get any answers from the board or community then, and he didn't press the issue. A board motion came up at a board meeting in 2018, but it failed for lack of a second. Bergfeld didn't think it was time. Events this summer apparently changed his mind. Trude's letter, opening as it did the soul of East Texas's largest town for international inspection, reads in part, "I am from Ghana, Africa, where slavery first began. I have stood in the dungeons of the slave castle and seen the 3-foot urine and feces stains on the walls where my brothers and sisters were kept. I've seen the tiny hole at the top of the ceiling where they would throw food into the captured souls. I have walked through the gate of no return, where over 12 million of my brothers and sisters were kidnapped, never to return back to their home." Trude wrote that she couldn't attend or support or compete for a school named after a person who was against my people right here in the United States. Even worse, she told CNN, is the notion of singing the school's alma mater. "Robert E. Lee, we raise our voices in praise of your name. May glory and honor ever guide you to fame." Trude's adoptive mother, Lauren Owens, told CNN she wanted the name changed immediately, and if it wasn't, she threatened a lawsuit for violation of civil rights. As you can imagine, reaction varied wildly. A fourth-generation nephew of Lee agreed it was time for a change and praised Trude for her courage. Anonymous threats posted on social media by others underscored his sentiments. On the other hand, Trude's position allowed her to meet Earl Campbell, pride of Tyler and the greatest football player in the state's glorious history. Before she left, he presented her with an autographed Oilers jersey inscribed with her full name, to Gertrude. Along about the same time, Mary Crawford, Tyler ISD superintendent since 2014, got a call. It was Earl. The last time they talked was in 1994 at a Willie Nelson concert in Willie's bus. Crawford figured he was calling to peddle a change at Lee. "No, sir," Earl told him. "I'm calling because I think it's time we change both of them." Not just Robert E. Lee then, but Earl's alma mater, John Tyler, the school he led to a state football title in 1973. Earl said it was important for everyone in the community, and important to their heirs as well, to know that these people stood up and did the right thing. Certainly, others contributed to what Crawford called a shift in the community's thinking. The board, led by Wade Washman, and named last year one of the five best in the state by the Texas Association of School Administrators, was influenced by Kevin Altife, a former state senator and Tyler mayor. But it was Earl's take that galvanized the John Tyler community and the town as a whole. When he was able to lend his voice to it, Crawford said, it became a Tyler thing. As for who influenced Earl, who'd pretty much remained a black man apart in all these protests. "I think when I read about Trude," he told Tyler's KLTV, "I said, you know, there's no sense in hiding it anymore." Rebranding begins. The 40 Tyler residents who voiced their feelings at Thursday's board meeting had 80 seconds each to get it off their chests. More than a few failed to make deadline. A middle-aged white male with a ball cap pulled hard on his brow had gotten only to the point in his notes where he insisted that the Civil War wasn't fought over slavery before Washman politely cut him off. The speaker left without complaint. All things considered, the speeches were remarkably civil given the temperature of some of the residents. An elderly white male said he hated to see our city in turmoil, which it is. Like several who opposed change, he blamed it on outsiders. A black female took exception, saying the African-American community in Tyler simply hadn't been heard. You could hear them Thursday, as a middle-aged black male told the board that this could have been done long ago. His comments were all but drowned out by chants from outside the room. Change the name, change the name. A middle-aged white male in a plaid blazer told board members they might as well do something because it'll happen eventually anyway. Better to do it now and avoid hindering economic growth. We may be the last holdout of the Confederacy, he added. That's not the message to send. Once the speakers were done, the board asked district officials for cost estimates on rebranding. Fritz Hager, executive pastor of Bethel Bible Church, as well as a West Point graduate and Silver Star recipient, told fellow board members he'd already talked to community members who said they would cover the costs. Andy Bergfeld, who asked the board a question 3 years ago, finally had an answer. He's no liberal. In fact, he called the radical progressive cultural revolution sweeping America a threat to community and country. Even so, changing names, he said, didn't check any boxes of the cancel culture. It's not a political movement, he said. It's what's in my heart. The vote was 7-0 in favor. At today's regularly scheduled meeting, the board will announce a naming process. Crawford recommended that, whatever they decide, just don't name the schools after anyone this time. And now, just for the record, on a number of occasions before his death in 1870, Robert E. Lee downplayed or discouraged monuments or memorials to the war. He was for reconciliation, not remembrance. In a letter declining an invitation to a Gettysburg memorial in 1869, he wrote that he thought it best, quote, not to keep open the sores of war, but to follow the examples of those nations who endeavored to obliterate the marks of civil strife and to commit to oblivion the feelings it engendered, unquote. My favorite Lee story begins with a woman who arrived, invited him to her home north of Lexington, where she showed him the remains of a once magnificent tree, its limbs stripped and trunk shattered by federal cannons. She'd left it, she told Lee, as a memorial to the pain the South had endured. If she was looking for affirmation from the great general, she was disappointed. "Cut it down, my dear madam," he told her, "and forget it." This article is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This article is entitled, Lubbock Police Car Seat Program, Result of Officers' Compassion, by Gabriel Monte, Lubbock Avalanche Journal. A Lubbock police detective's act of kindness and compassion during a routine traffic stop 2 years ago snowballed into a major effort that looks to protect thousands of children on roadways. While patrolling 19th Street, Lubbock Police Detective Kyle Perdue spotted a family riding in a vehicle with an unrestrained child. The one-year-old child was sitting in his mother's lap and not in a child seat. Perdue, who now works as a tactical flight officer in the department's Special Operations Narcotics and Vice Unit, stopped the vehicle and ticketed the driver for having an unrestrained child. It's a citation given about 400 times a year in Lubbock, he said. You've got to realize that number, 400, only counts what we have cited, Perdue said Tuesday. It doesn't include the people that have done it for years and gotten away with it. So it is a pretty systemic problem. Back at the traffic stop, a thought nagged at him as he walked back to his vehicle. The hundreds of car wrecks he's encountered as a crash investigator on the police force. I realized I had done nothing for that child at that moment, he said. When he got back to his vehicle, he removed the child seat he had installed for his son, who was the same age as the unrestrained child, and gave it to the family. The family came away with a much-needed car seat, and Perdue came away with the idea for a program that had the potential to save more young lives. Child car seats can reduce the risk of fatal injury in a crash by 71% for infants and by 54% for toddlers, according to National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Perdue, who spent 7.5 years of his 12.5-year career as a crash investigator with the Lubbock Police Department, has seen firsthand the tragic aftermath of unrestrained children in vehicle wrecks. The number one cause of children dying under the age of 18 in the United States is traffic accidents, he said. During that 7.5 years, our office worked over 350 accidents involving either fatal or life-threatening injuries. He said car seats could have protected those lives. As the importance of car safety seats cannot be understated, he realizes it's an expense many families cannot afford. A citation only adds to the financial burden that puts it further out of reach. With the help of Chief Floyd Mitchell, the Lubbock Police Department command staff, and the Parenting College, the Lubbock Police Department is implementing a car seat program to help those that have the smallest voices in our community, he said Tuesday during a ceremony where he received the South Plains Coalition for Child Abuse Prevention's Cherish the Children Award for his work in developing the program. The program will issue car safety seats to patrol officers who can use them in their vehicles when they have to take children away from a domestic violence situation or during traffic stops where they can give them to families that do not have a child safety seat. The officer is going to collect information from the family and be able to provide that to the parenting cottage, who will then make sure that the car seat is properly installed and then also provide further assets that they can offer to that family, he said. Perdue said the department obtained a grant for $11,000 to be used for car seats. We started off with, I think, 18 car seats and will order more as needed, he said. The seats won't be available to the public at the police department. Instead, families in need of a car seat can visit the Parenting Cottage, which has the program that teaches parents how to properly install car seats and provide them to families who qualify. Mayor Dan Pope, who spoke at the awards ceremony, said Perdue's actions highlight the compassion officers have for the community. What Kyle has done to improve the safety of our children, something that he saw firsthand as an accident investigator for Lubbock Police, shows, I think, the heart and the spirit and the love of the men and women who wear the badge, he said. State Senator Charles Perry told Perdue during the ceremony that he went above and beyond his role as a police officer. You extended a resource that was so practical in a time of need and stress where the average parent or the average cop would not be able to discern where we go from here, he said. You fixed that problem. Lubbock Police Department's car seat program already is being replicated at about a dozen law enforcement agencies in the South Plains, according to Carla Olson with the Parenting Cottage. She said Purdue's efforts in organizing the program will have far-reaching effects. It was very apparent to me that he had done his homework, she said. He had everything written down. He had costs. But what impressed me the most was he told me firsthand the things that he had witnessed. And that will make a believer out of you, I can tell you. He also thought, and I had to agree with him, that law enforcement was in a unique position to be a great advocate and community leader in promoting safety issues around vehicle safety, not just car seats, but hot cars and so many other things. Purdue said he didn't encounter any resistance when he approached community leaders about the program, which he said was encouraging. Lubbock is a loving community that cares about its citizens and especially its children, he said. So putting this all together, I realized that this is something that tugs on everybody's heart. It's an issue that affects our community and communities throughout the world. This article was distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This is the state page. NASA launches challenge to find better lunar toilet by Aaron Blakemore, special to the Washington Post. Humans are going back to the moon, but how will they go when they get there? NASA wants to build a better toilet for astronauts on its upcoming Artemis mission, a moon excursion with a target date of 2024, and it wants the public to help. The agency has mounted what it calls the Lunar Loo Challenge, a contest inviting designs from the global community in exchange for a prize purse of $35,000. Space presents a set of challenges for anyone who needs to use the toilet. The International Space Station has a toilet that was installed in the 1990s, but it is difficult to use and has resulted in messes and unpleasant odors. A new toilet, called Universal Waste Management System, is scheduled for installation this year, but it's designed for only the microgravity of space, not the lunar gravity of the moon. NASA is going to need a toilet that can be used on the moon's surface as well, and one that's small enough to be installed on the lunar lander. The challenge calls on the public to figure out how to capture sewage and smells in both microgravity and on the moon. NASA hopes the prize purse, which will be dispersed among three prize winners, will attract radically new and different approaches to the problem of human waste capture and containment. Kids can enter too. They'll receive non-cash prizes. Teams have until August 17th to submit their plans for a lunar loo. The adult winners will be announced September 30th and the younger winners on October 20th. Proposals will be evaluated on their quality, feasibility, the likelihood that the design could be developed within the next 2 to 3 years, and their innovation. Oh, and the toilet's ability to contain, in the agency's words, urine, feces accompanying simultaneous urination and defecation, diarrhea, vomit, and menses. People may soon walk the moon's surface, but they'll still be subject to the same inconveniences as people on Earth. Ready to tackle the toilet challenge? Learn more at herox.com/lunarloo. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled "Now is the Time to Prepare for Coronavirus Vaccine" by Megan McArdle, Washington Post Writers Group. July has been the best and the worst month so far for Americans who are hoping for an expeditious resolution to the COVID-19 crisis. It is the worst month because America's COVID response has been a vast and humiliating disaster. As European caseloads decline towards zero, the United States is flirting with new records. While Europeans resume dinner parties, the United States is wondering if it can reopen primary schools. Americans who have been trapped inside for months are starting to feel despair clawing at them. And worse, looking across the Atlantic to realize their suffering isn't even necessary. Nevertheless, July was the best month because we have gotten encouraging news on two vaccines, one from Pfizer BioNTech and the other from Moderna. Both showed strong results in early trials, and both companies are plowing ahead into the final stage of testing. Anthony Fauci, the federal government's top infectious disease expert, has publicly stated that he thinks we might have a vaccine by the end of the year. That's far from a guarantee, but it is real enough and tantalizing enough that we need to start planning now so that we don't screw up the vaccine the way we screwed up the first phase of the coronavirus response. To defeat COVID-19, we may well have to vaccinate everyone, or as close to everyone as we can. That kind of vaccination campaign, the kind that could really make everything go back to normal, is going to take a vast, coordinated public effort on a scale that we may not have seen since the United States rolled out draft cards and ration books during World War II. That's not yet commonly understood, because most people think of vaccine as an individual benefit. You get a shot, or maybe a series of them, and then you're immune. And yes, vaccines often do work that way, but the protection they provide is imperfect. Some people who are vaccinated never muster a strong protective immune response. For example, childhood vaccines, the rate of vaccine failure is 5 to 15%. That failure rate is likely to be higher in older people whose immune systems aren't so robust. But even when the shots do work, the effectiveness often wanes over time, which is why you have to get booster shots for tetanus. Yet we've nonetheless managed to eliminate, or nearly so, once common childhood diseases through herd immunity, a concept you've likely been hearing about recently. If enough people have immunity, the virus keeps running into dead ends as it tries to spread and eventually burns out. So though many of us adults have probably lost some of the immunity that we once acquired through childhood vaccinations, we're still safe from those diseases because we've thoroughly immunized the main reservoir, school buildings full of runny-nosed children, where those diseases used to spread. So people who are imagining that as soon as we get a vaccine, they can get a shot and go on with their lives, need to be aware of the real risk that we get a vaccine fairly quickly, but it's only modestly effective. Moreover, its effectiveness would be particularly modest in the elderly we are most eager to protect, the elderly and immunocompromised. Which means that we need to have plans now to get everyone immunized so that everyone can safely go outside. The logics alone are daunting. We might not reach true normal until a sizable majority of the country is vaccinated and our traditional method for fighting infectious disease, required immunization to attend primary school, won't achieve that. How do we purchase, store, and distribute all those doses? How do we keep track of who has been vaccinated, particularly if vaccination requires multiple doses? All this needs to be resolved at the federal level as much as possible, because in a country as open, as mobile as the United States, we're all only as well as our sickest fellow state. Such a response cannot be mounted on the fly. We need to be building the capacity right now, even if that means that we staff up agencies and buildings that sit idle for a year as we wait for the right vaccine candidate. But the logistical problems seem almost trivial compared to the political problems. The COVID-19 response has been almost hopelessly politicized, even over small precautions like masks. Resistance is likely to become stiffer still when authorities want to inject something into someone's body, especially since that resistance will tap into pre-existing reserves of anti-vaccination fervor that were already overflowing on both the right and the left. President Donald Trump, who has done more than any other figure to polarize our COVID-19 response, will undoubtedly fan those flames of whatever resistance does arrive, particularly if he loses in November. One can imagine a solution that would bypass his interference, a serious bipartisan congressional commission to make recommendations, a Republican leadership that enthusiastically promotes them. But if we want this country to get back to normal anytime soon, we'll need to do more than imagine it. This column is called Guest View. It is entitled Biggest Stimulus Already Belongs to the People by Hugh Hewitt, special to the Washington Post. The biggest pot of money to help Americans climb back to full employment and restart the thriving economy of a year ago is also the hardest to unlock, the one holding the retirement accounts of millions of Americans. To restart the economy, Congress needs to give Americans access to their own savings. If Americans could withdraw up to half or a third or even a quarter of the funds they have saved for retirement, hundreds of thousands of Americans would do so. And they would use those funds to rebuild their lives and survive this economic storm. The economic takeoff would be sharp and prolonged. Your retirement assets reached $29.1 trillion as of March 31, 2019. You read that right. Americans had by that date tucked away more than $29 trillion. And though that number would have dropped with the markets in March 2020, it will have rebounded since then. A study by the Investment Company Institute showed that retirement assets accounted for a third of all household financial assets in the United States. The pool of funds to power the recovery is vast. These assets are held in different ways and in all sorts of investments, most beyond the reach of individuals under present law. But trillions could be made accessible to individuals if Congress acted. In the most recent phase of the rescue legislation, crafted in large part by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, some small steps were taken to ease the burdens of the coronavirus on businesses and families by allowing loans from their retirement savings. It's time for bolder steps. Let Americans decide for themselves what to do with the money they have saved. Better yet, a massive tax cut to allow penalty-free withdrawals of up to 50% of an individual's retirement assets. Better still, tax all 2020 withdrawals at a flat rate of no more than 15% and perhaps lower. The point is to get people back on their feet with their own money, not add to tax revenue. Or, sit down, financial planners, perhaps make those withdrawals tax-free. That would be an unprecedented step. But right now, Americans are hitting walls. They need an extraordinary measure for an extraordinary crisis. Would a nationwide raid on Americans' retirement accounts tank the stock market? Not for long, if at all, as the market would come back to where the savings-fueled rebuild takes root, and some immediate boost would come as tax-advantaged savings are moved into equities. The impact on the deficit would be minor, as these assets aren't generating tax revenue right now anyway. A low flat tax would actually help reduce this year's yawning ocean of red ink. Americans have saved and saved. It's time to allow them to decide for themselves what to withdraw and put to good use and what to leave still growing in tax-protected accounts. It's a complicated calculation for every American, but free individuals are best positioned to make the calculation for themselves. And people prudent enough to have saved for retirement will make prudent decisions for themselves and their families. McConnell is right to insist the Phase 4 rescue bill include liability protection from COVID-19 claims. Without that protection, there would be endless lawsuits against private businesses and institutions. No one would be spared. A plague of lawsuits, not colleges, schools, hospitals, museums, and certainly not deep-pocketed businesses, as the nation tries to return to normal. That's priority one. Priority two for the next rescue bill is the nation's security. The shocking fire injuring dozens on the amphibious assault ship Bonhomme Richard opened more eyes to the perilous state of the U.S. Navy, charged with protection protecting the freedom of the seas. The Navy has got to grow in phase four. But many ordinary Americans need a major boost, and it is hiding in plain sight. Congress must let Americans use their own money. It is their money, Republicans and Democrats. We've never been in this situation before. Let Americans use their own money.
Do chromium or biotin have a role in treating type 2 diabetes? To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach, Wednesday, July 22nd. Dear Dr. Roach, do chromium or biotin have a role in treating type 2 diabetes? Answer. There was a great deal of enthusiasm for chromium picolinate a few years ago, and there is still evidence that the combination of chromium and biotin may decrease insulin resistance in people with type 2 diabetes. Recent studies have suggested that these may improve glucose control, although the improvement was small, about 5%, in a 2-hour glucose tolerance test. By themselves, they are not likely to dramatically improve control in people with type 2 diabetes, particularly if they are not well controlled. However, it may be enough to tip the balance in some people. I am not yet ready to recommend it generally, despite a good safety profile.
Dear Abby, terms of endearment have opposite effect on woman. Dear Abby, my boyfriend and I are middle-aged. We have been together for 2.5 years. I love him, and I'm grateful for such a wonderful man at this point in my life. My problem is he calls me sweet baby every time he addresses me. Sweet baby, what do you need help with? Sweet baby, I'm on my way. What did you say, sweet baby? Even when it comes to trying to be affectionate, he'll say, "You're my sweet baby, aren't you?" He asks this over and over and over, and then says, "You're my sweet baby." Abby, I could probably take it occasionally, but his continuous use of it now makes me cringe. I hate it. I have told him how much I'd prefer for him to use my name, but he won't. He continues with the sweet baby in texts, calls, in person, constantly. I'm starting to wonder if he's doing it deliberately. He, in turn, likes being called Big Daddy, but I won't do it. He's not my daddy, and I don't care for pet names. How can one little thing like that be so annoying? To the point that I'm beginning to avoid him and visit him less. It breaks my heart because we can have such a good time together, but he is ruining it. I'm trying not to end a wonderful relationship. I feel that by ignoring my request, he's being rude. Your advice? Cringing in the South. Dear Cringing, your boyfriend may be following a script he has written in his head. Has it occurred to you that sweet baby may be what he has called all the women in his life, which would make it less a term of endearment than rote recitation? After 2 years of this, you should have made clear to him that sweet baby is not only not having the desired effect, but it's making you cringe. While you are at it, tell him plainly that you have an aversion to pet names like Big Daddy, because one daddy was enough for you and you neither want nor need another one. If you can't communicate what you really feel, then indeed this romance isn't going to last, so you might as well speak up. Dear Abby, my 14-year-old son and I recently went to visit family a few hours away. We stayed at my mother's home. My mother overheard him talking to his male friend about engaging in sexual activity with him. He thought everyone was asleep when she overheard the conversation. I never suspected that my son might be gay or bi, she told me in private the next day. Should I say something to him about what she heard? I don't want to embarrass him, and my mother doesn't want him knowing what she heard. Should I keep quiet? Caught by surprise in Texas. Dear Cot, your mother may have misinterpreted what she heard. Your son is at an age when he is trying to figure out who he is. I don't think it would be constructive to talk to him about what she told you, so bide your time. Let him know you love him and are always available to listen and talk with him about anything that might concern him. But the topic of his sexual orientation should be raised by him, not you. Dear Abby's written by Abigail Van Buren, also known as Jean Phillips, and was founded by her mother, Pauline Phillips. Contact Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Jacqueline Bigger Stars by Madeline Aslan. Note, Bigger Stars is based on the degree of your sun at birth. The sign name is simply a label that astrologers put on a set of degrees for convenience. For best results, readers should refer to the dates following each sign. A baby born today has a sun in Cancer until 3:37 a.m., when the sun enters Leo, and a moon in Leo until 7:40 p.m., when the moon enters Virgo. Happy birthday for Wednesday, July 22, 2020. Courageous and success-oriented, your life goes up and down like the ocean waves. This year, you will do well. Your success depends on a new structure. If single, a flirtation blooms into an intimate romance after the summer. If attached, you are a handful for your partner, who adores you nevertheless. The best times for you are when you recharge together. Taurus sticks with you through thick and thin. The stars show the kind of day you'll have. 5 dynamic, 4 positive, 3 average, 2 so-so, 1 difficult. Aries, March 21 through April 19. 5 stars. Friends include you in projects that combined pleasure with serious work. You have the opportunity to become more active in a worthwhile organization. Leisure pursuits will be stimulating mentally as well as physically. Tonight, dance like there's no one watching. Taurus, April 20 through May 20. 3 stars. Family members are growing and changing. Your residence might require remodeling, minor repairs, or redecorating to make it more comfortable for everyone. Be patient with less than perfect family situations. Problems will smooth over. Tonight, add more fun to the moment. Gemini, May 21 through June 20. 4 stars. Your natural acting ability and charisma will be expressed in your conversations and emails today. Don't adhere too closely to old habits and ideas. New information brings a different viewpoint to the fore. Business travel will be productive. Tonight, catch up with long-lost friends. Cancer, June 21 through July 22. 3 stars. Your birth sign is shared with more bankers and millionaires than any other. There has been financial upheaval lately, however. Be flexible and don't invest in risky ventures today. Take advice with a proverbial grain of salt. Practice being patient. Tonight, defer to a child. Leo, July 23 through August 22. 5 stars. Your natural effervescence shines. You are gratified as avenues for fulfillment of desires open. There is an overall brightness of outlook today. Your creativity is at a peak. Express the artist within. Tonight, celebrate yourself as only you know how. Virgo, August 23 through September 22. 2 stars. It is best to work behind the scenes today and avoid any conflicts or confrontations, especially with women. Keep your deepest feelings secret. Unconscious attitudes can be difficult. You might be dealing with a matter from the past. Tonight, read between the lines. Libra, September 23 through October 22. 3 stars. Control your impulses today. Set aside romantic notions for the time being. Persevere and fulfill your obligations. You are building foundations for your creativity. Emphasize quality. Examine your overall goals. These goals should be an expression of who you are. Tonight, rest easy. Scorpio, October 23 through November 21. 4 stars. Focus on creating the right impression. Combine professional expertise with the human touch, and your project is off to a wonderful beginning. Be aware of patterns at work, and keep a sense of humor about office gossip. Tonight, show what you're made of. Sagittarius, November 22 through December 21. 5 stars. You're inspired to begin a new study. Through the day, you feel motivated. The competitive spirit others recognize in you will be in full flower. You make every effort to be a winner and have an excellent chance of doing so. Tonight, up late. Capricorn, December 22 through January 19. 5 stars. Fate takes a hand in the direction of your money situation. Friends offer financial opportunities. The path to realizing a long-cherished financial goal opens today. Investments, settlements, or possibly an inheritance is involved. Tonight, get a good night's sleep. Aquarius, January 20 through February 18. 4 stars. Partners and associates are going through a catharsis. Don't take it personally if a familiar group breaks up. Let others grow and change. Cultivate new social and business contacts. You will charm and attract others. Tonight, dinner with your most loved ones. Pisces, February 19 through March 20. 5 stars. The impact of long-time health and eating habits become apparent today. It is an excellent time to draw down the lunar energy for healing. Reach fitness goals with patience and attention to detail. Tonight, a fateful meeting opens new doors. Born today, poet Emma Lazarus, 1849, artist Edward Hopper, 1882, actor Willem Dafoe, 1955.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.